We're back on. Okay, thanks.
So I asked him for this sabbatical in Alaska, and he agreed. He said that would be fabulous. So I got here, and I probably was working for about 5 or 6 weeks, I guess, on putting together these concepts of how you would go forward with this. And I get a call, and it's the chief. And he said, Mark, I want you to do this one more time. I said, what do you want me to do? And he said, I want you to go to Somalia and see if you can make yourself useful. That was my order. Go to Somalia and see if, you know. I got a set of orders. I hope I still have these. Someday I'll go through all the trunks and everything and try to find these. Had a set of orders that said, the bearer of these orders is on special assignment from the chief of staff of the Army. He is authorized to go anywhere at any time using any form of transportation, foreign and domestic. Paragraph 2, variations authorized. I said, Chief, I'd have been there 24 hours earlier, but I kept trying to figure out something this didn't cover. You know, it's a standard paragraph put in on orders all the time. But I actually had those orders. I thought, these are precious.
Oh, yes.
You got to actually show somebody these things. So I went over to Somalia, and...
And what year was this, Mark?
This is going to be 92.
Okay.
So this is like way before Black Hawk Down and all that kind of stuff. And the Marines were in charge there, and I met them, and Tony Zinni was running that, and he gave me some briefings. But the only place there was any fighting was down in Kismayo. You had the 6th Mountain Division. That didn't sound right. 6th Mountain? Yeah, I think it's the 6th Mountain. And they were down in Kismayo. So I went down there. And down there, they had the city of Kismayo was essentially occupied by a guy by the name of Omar Jess. About 6,000 troops in there. And outside the city, was a guy by the name of Hershey Morgan, who was Adid's son-in-law. And he was named the Butcher of Baidoa, because by reports he had just slaughtered everybody, man, woman, child, goats, camels, you know, kind of a thing. Can't vouch for the reality of that, but that was who he was. So I said, okay, I mean, let's, first of all, contact, okay? Sit down and talk with these people. That's what you need to do. Omar Jess was clearly an evil man, and I'll give you some certainty of that in a minute, but well, I talked to Hershey Morgan, and very, very interesting chat. In essence, said the warlords are just hired guns. The real power here is from the sultans, which is apparently the pronunciation they use. And we just want peace. Okay. Let's talk about this. I mean, I can do this. And we started to talk about it. And there are a couple of very, very simple rules. One is, in that negotiations, you have to represent being absolutely powerless. Because otherwise they want to use you. You're a tool. I can use you. And so the answer to anything that they wanted was, I can't do it. But I can identify something you could do that would make it more likely. It's okay. That kind of a kind of a thing. And you know, I mean, oh, come on! I know you can't. You can do it. No, absolutely powerless. I mean, the ambassador. I don't work for the ambassador. You know. And, anyway, Morgan was a very interesting fella. I mean, we're. were out there. I mean, you're literally in the middle of thorn trees and ostriches and lions and giraffes.
Wow.
I mean, this is right near the Kenyan border. Out there eating a camel liver, which is number one, good, and number two, the most remarkable piece of meat you've ever seen. A camel liver is about that big. I mean, just gigantic. It's actually very good. I mean, okay. Really enjoyed it.
We'll take your word for it.
So Hershey and I would chow that down, and I would bring him a little pouch of tobacco. He smoked a pipe. So, he had agreed with me, you stay here. I don't need, because he had tried to attack Kismayo once before, and the Sixth Mountain just ripped him up.
Ooh.
I mean, Cobra helicopters just ripped him up. And I said, don't come back. I mean, you know, we'll kill you. I mean, that's all there is to it. Yeah. So one day, about 2 o'clock in the morning, okay, let me stop. Omar Jess controlled the town. What he would do is, anytime he was peeved at all about the American presence, he would yell, "Morgan is coming." Well, this is where perhaps the whole myth could have been totally made up of the Butcher of Baidoa,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because everybody was terrified. And what would happen is most of the population would run down to the docks, which is where we were, and start throwing stones over the barbed wire fence, oh. you know, at the Americans, whom he said, back Morgan. And the Americans were not backing anybody. They just said, stay away. And Omar Jess was already in the town, so there's not much you can do with him unless you just fought him. And we chose not to do that. So one day, about 2 o'clock in the morning, automatic weapon fire from every single part of Kismayo. People announcing over loudspeakers, "Morgan has taken the city."
Mm.
Well, 6,000 of Jess's forces and Jess and everybody else went about 12 miles out the city, because that's where I found them the next day. And of course I go, what just happened here? Get a hold of Hershey Morgan and just rip his lips off, you know. Every single one of these warlords, guerrillas I've ever talked to counts as an absolutely non-negotiable virtue is their word.
Mm-hmm.
I know, I used to tell people, and it sounds terrible, but it's something I absolutely believe, that in two wars on two different continents, the difference between the State Department and the warlords that I talked to was, the warlords never lied to me.
Hmm.
Wonderful virtue to have. Any case, so I call up Morgan and rip him up. And, you know, I mean, you told me. You wouldn't. He said, "Colonel, look, I don't have total control over these people. He was born in Kismayo, knew how to get in through the sewer pipes and everything else,
yes.
and he did it. What do you want me to do?" I said, "Well, you tell him to come and see me immediately at the docks." And I said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to line up some trucks, put his soldiers on them. I'll put all their weapons on the last truck, okay? And they're going to drive back to you. And tailing them will be a special forces team so that I can have sat phone communications mm-hmm. and always know exactly where you are." I said, "Okay." So Colonel Anselmi comes down to the thing, and guards greet him and bring him in. And the first thing he did is, he's got this grin on his face again. He said, good op, huh? Good operation. I said, great. It was high five. I mean, it was fabulous. Okay, here's what you're going to do. And he did all those things, and I sent the folks out there. Then I went out to see Omar Jess, and I said, if you move back toward the city, we will kill you. To demonstrate how unafraid he was of that sort of thing, he just had a person dragged up and stoned to death about 60 yards away.
From you?
From me.
Oh.
We're sitting under a tree, and he had a man stoned to death. And, you know, at that stage of the game, again, you know, flip back through. Where's this cover? Where's the manual on people's... What do you say when people stone people to death in front of you? I've never actually encouraged... You know,
yeah.
And so, you know, I just said, do you understand that there is no civilized nation on earth that will respect that kind of reaction? You're going to lose all credibility with any of the civilized world. You can't do that. So that's about it. You know, you're done with the preaching. Anyway, now we had Kismayo. Morgan is out near the Kenyan border. Jess is 12 miles away and isn't going anywhere. And so we got the sultans together, had them select a group of policemen, essentially. The UN gave them uniforms and arms. The 10th Mountain Division, that's what I called it in the 6th, the 10th Mountain Division went home. The day they left, I got a hold of the sat phone, called up the chief, and I said, it's going to get really lonely here. Okay, the 10th Mountain's going home. Can I come home? He said, well, on your way, I want you to go to Brussels and talk with Shelly Kashvili, who's the supreme Allied commander of Europe, and later chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
Yes.
But and tell Shelly what he needs to do with this Vance Owen peace plan. So I go to Brussels, and spent some time with his headquarters there. Went to Geneva and talked with Owen's assistant there. Colonel Mercevy Whiting, I think was his name, as I recall. And we talked about it a little bit. Went to Zagreb. And finally I come back and I walk in and talk to Shelly, as everybody called him, General Shelly Kashvili. And I said, sir, I know you're busy. I'm going to make this short. The Vance Owen peace plan will never be signed. If it's signed, we can't implement it. And if we implement it, it wouldn't bring peace. If you have the option, run, don't walk away from this. If you don't have the option, you need to assign the best logistician in the entire armed forces, active or retired. That's my briefing. And thank you, Mark. All right. So then I get the word, okay, Shelley's going to fly his plane back to D.C. Tomorrow, and he wants you to come along and you can chat some more. So we did, in fact, chat some more and everything else. I went in and visited the chief, and I said, I'm not a strategic planner and all this kind of stuff. I don't know if I did Shelley anything. He said, well, actually, I talked to Shelley this morning. He'd just like to borrow you for a couple of months. I said, can I go see Patty? He said, how long would you need? A week? All right, a week. So I went.
Where was she at that?
In Alaska.
Yeah, she was here. Okay.
Yeah. And back over I go, and I spent some time with his staff trying to do the implementation of this. This is the former Yugoslavia phenomena. And spent some time with his staff, and then as the Supreme Allied Headquarters, they pass it down to another group. It's another four-star group headed by a Navy admiral by the name of Borda. So we went down there to present the plan. What they presented was the back brief. Mm-hmm. Another great leadership thing that I've never, ever let go of. What they do in the armed forces is they give you an order, okay? So they go, okay, there you are, Gene, there's the order. I'll talk to you in 1 week about how you interpret that and what you're planning to do about it. Mm-hmm. And that's called a back brief.
Okay.
Very powerful
yes.
thing. Very powerful exchange. I won't go into all the values of the back brief, but they're absolutely fascinating. So we brought it down to Naples, and they were going to have a back brief on this. And the back brief there, quite an event. I mean, got all kind of NATO partners, and I mean, just stars everywhere you look and everything like that. And so the announcement is made that by Borda that the staff will do it, and then Colonel Hamilton is going to critique it.
That's your first you heard of it?
First I ever heard of it. I'm gonna critique it. I mean, there's generals standing up doing this thing, and Colonel Hamilton's going to critique it. So I took some good notes, and I did, in fact, critique it and pointed out strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, etc. So I'm climbing back on the plane here with Shally, and he said, "Oh, Mark, I told Borda he could borrow you for a couple of weeks." So here I am in the second time in a row that I have arrived someplace and have to go buy underwear, shaving kit. I just dropped off. Here it is. Anyway, so I spent some time with them, and finally they let me come home. But a fascinating thing had happened in the meantime. ABC News used to have a guy named Peter Jennings. Mm-hmm. And Peter Jennings sent a team over to Somalia, and it was kind of who is this masked man here? We have an army guy who does peace, and who is he, and everything. And so they went around with me for a couple of days, and Peter Jennings makes me his person of the week.
Yes.
So my take on that, because of what happened, was a Canadian did in 5 minutes what I couldn't do with 26 years of dedicated service. He got me promoted to general. Okay. It's real. So here we are, a little family all gathered here in Alaska, finally there, finally together and everything else, and bang. Okay, general, you're going to Hawaii, and you've got 17 days. Well, so you had to, we bought horses, because yes. Patty always wanted to have horses. We bought a dog, we bought a house. Well, we had the house, okay.
You were Alaska residents at that point in time then?
Yeah,
yes.
I was here for keeps, yeah. Yeah, when I was here militarily, I did not sign up for the permanent fund because I just didn't like the idea. Mm-hmm. I wanted to come back, but I couldn't be certain. And even after I bought the house, it was when I came back again that I said, okay, and then I signed up.
Yes.
For the permanent fund. So where am I? I'm heading for, the whole family was just crushed. Uh-huh. You know, we had to have this whole meeting. So, okay, look, guys, you understand you're being, Dad just got promoted to general. We're going from Alaska to Hawaii. Nobody's going to feel sorry for you.
Okay, honey, nobody.
Just keep it to yourself. Sulk in private. Nobody is going to feel sorry for you. So we went over there, and then I just had other wonderful opportunities, wonderful jobs in the Army, and ended up as the commander of the United States Recruiting Command, which 12,000 employees, entire United States, Germany, Korea. Quite a massive organization. Salesmanship or something probably was the only assignment I had done that appealed to the regents as, oh, a recruiter.
Yes.
Maybe he can recruit some, you know. Yes. It's about the only thing I had that people thought was tangible. In fact, my entire career,
yes,
the entire leadership experience of all those years translated beautifully. There was essentially zero transition to come in and lead the university.
Before we get to the university, you have four kids.
Yes, wonderful, beautiful kids. Douglas, who lives in Northern Virginia, has four children that he and Michelle are just doing a beautiful, beautiful job with. Clay, who's a fireman in Anchorage, and also the founder of CrossFit in Alaska, had the very first gym, which he still owns, doing absolutely beautiful. And he has my oldest grandchild, a granddaughter, and another a girl, Renee and Avery. And then Kathy, who we had come into our lives at about the age of four, maybe something like that. Kathy is just a wonderful, beautiful lady. She's the children's pastor at Friends Church, and married a very nice young fella from Kentucky, Ben, who now works for Doyon. And they have four kids. Wonderful, sweet, adorable. So we've got 10 grandchildren.
Wow.
They're just a joy, an absolute joy. Something magic about it. There really is. People brush it off as, oh, I get to love them up and then turn them back to their family. It's way, way bigger than that. It's a very powerful thing, grandparenting. I've loved it. I love being a dad, too. Though,
yeah.
So.
And then Daniel.
Daniel and I just went hunting. We got into the grandkids, and he isn't even married yet. So Daniel is a nationally certified automotive mechanic, went to the program at UAA, where 2 years, mm-hmm, mechanics, and you earn your associate's degree. And he's very, very happy with that. Maybe you'll be more grandkids. Mm-hmm.
I remember during your intermediate interview that we did when you were still, I believe, at Fort Knox when we did that. I can't recall, but I think that's where you were. One of the questions that somebody asked you was about diversity. And your response to that question was about your two youngest children. Do you remember what your answer was on that? About you, how you could prove that you did believe in diversity? I remember it well.
I don't remember it, so I'll be informed by what you tell me. But just off the top of my head, I know this. I know that the concern that virtually everyone has in adopting children is, am I going to love them as much as the biological children that I have? And I can tell you, the transition is exactly one hug.
Mm-hmm. How did you come about deciding to adopt and adopt from Korea?
Well, actually, Patty and I had some difficulties in children. We had a miscarriage, and we had a stillborn child. Mm-hmm. And those are, you know, on the scale of human pain, those was a pretty tough. So, but we wanted children. We both loved being parents. But the fact that you have two perfectly wonderful, happy, healthy biological children actually works against you.
Yes.
The next thing that works against you is we couldn't stay anywhere long enough to get through the process.
Mm-hmm.
One day, Patty was doing volunteer work, which she constantly does, and she was being a secretary there. Being ecumenical, she was being a secretary to a Catholic priest, which was fine. I mean, you know. And he came in and said, would you consider adopting an Amerasian child? And, you know, this kind of...
We're good. We're fine.
Yeah, we're fine.
This kind of worked in with the... typically, they were children of soldiers.
Yes.
Okay, in Korea. So, sure, that sounded good to us. And so we were going to try that. And what happened was, kind of right in the middle of it, they changed the law and kind of said that an Amerasian child would be given a preference in coming to the United States and could take their mom with them.
Mm.
So what really happened was they became a ticket
yes.
to the U.S. and yes. shoo, dried up instantly. They were
yeah.
gone.
Yeah,
they were absolutely gone. I'm going to put this skull in my mouth.
You may do
cut
so.
Cut this. So... that didn't work out, but we then kind of heard, okay, if you're willing to take, kind of challenged children who are either multiple or some sort of thing and everything else, and I will tell you, that was a time of, well, you want to talk about sitting down and looking your spouse and yourself right in the soul. You sit down and fill out an adoption paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's brutal. I mean, there are pages and pages and pages of very specific questions, okay? Would you adopt a child who was had trouble seeing, with one eye, with no eyes, hearing, like fingers, toes, on. Patty, I just said, this is ridiculous. Crossed it out. Wrote a note. Note said, we'll take up to four, because we determined that that was the absolute max of our ability to support.
Mm-hmm.
And the only requirement we have is that they be able to understand that they are loved.
Mm-hmm.
So we turned that in, and we're second guessing, how are we doing, everything, huh? Very much on our mind. And we said, okay, we just really need to pray about this.
Yes.
So we go to church that Sunday. And here we had, you just have Protestant and Catholic in there. In this particular Protestant, this was Lutheran and Nordic man, very tall, very imposing, unbelievably serious kind of a thing. And followed all, I mean, this, we're going to have the third sermon on Timothy, and that's what we're going to have today. But he stops and says, I have to interrupt this. He said, I can't do this series. I have to share something with you. Whoa, got my attention. What he shared was, he had a sister who was adopted. You start. And they didn't tell her. Again, kind of Lutheran, kind of, they didn't tell her. When she found out, she disowned them.
Yes.
Completely. They had, then he went on to talk about adoption and how that is talked about in the scripture, and that using the appropriate translation, being the sons of God, is the adopted sons of God. Mm-hmm. So I turned around to Patty and I said, you know, they don't do any burning bushes.
But
anymore, this is the sign. I mean, it's absurd. You can't make this up.
Yes.
Look what just happened. Well, I have often thought how easy life could be if you really did think that this was a mission given to you mm-hmm. by a higher power. Because I'll give you an example. I mean, you go through so much junk with adoption, it's just absolutely terrible. And some of it's necessary, and I understand it. The rest of it, I have challenged people for years with this thought. I will give you, I'll go first, my best bureaucracy nightmare, and then you top it. Okay? Here I am. We're going to adopt two children. Go to Seattle. We're in the state of Washington. Go to Seattle. Okay, fine. Okay, you need to get an FBI background check. Okay, go in, fingerprint, FBI background check. Weeks, 2-3 months, whatever it was. Got it. Go back up to Seattle. Ta-da! There's our background checks. Oh, well, you wanted to adopt two children. You'll need another background check. I said, well, just Xerox it. No, you need to have a separate background check. Excuse me, point of order. I only have one background. What are we going to do? I said, I need to talk to your supervisor. Supervisor comes out and backs the person. And my entire response to that, which I couldn't possibly have projected had I not had this experience. Okay, near the background check, gonna go get one. See, this actually wasn't my idea. Okay, God told me to
do it. Yeah. Still didn't back off, though, did they?
Oh, no. No, I went and we sat down, did thing. 4 weeks later, came back. Got two background checks. Oh, my gracious.
So, two, and how old were Kathy?
Kathy
and...
was about 4. Mm-hmm. And Daniel was about 18 months. Okay. You're guessing, you know.
Yes.
And, you know, we thought we can pretty much figure out Daniel because he'll get two-year-old molars, and then, but his previous diet had not supported that, so we never got two-year-old molars, so we just stuck with our first guess. And you understand you have to name them if you want to change their name to an Americanized name. You have to give them a birthday.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, how can you have a birth certificate if you don't have a birth date?
That's right.
And they didn't, you know,
they didn't have one.
No.
Were they siblings?
Yes.
They're siblings.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, oh God, they just came together. I mean, Kathy probably held his hand for the first year everywhere they would go. This is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. Yeah, well, I mean, I get emotional just thinking about them.
Absolutely.
I'll give you one that I'll never be able to get through here, but I'll just choke it up and do it. When we knew we were going to get them.
Turn this off?
No, that's okay. I don't mind crying, actually. I actually don't.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually don't trust people who don't cry. Any case. they sent us pictures, and then we sent pictures back, you know, and had them in a, you know, the 8x10 big thing of mom and dad. So when you get to the orphanage, and I've always said, thank God, every child was claimed, because otherwise I just would have grabbed an armful and taken them with me. Yeah. I mean, no question. I just would have said, okay, you, come on, you can get in. So they're in the back getting dressed up in their best little clothes. Oh, God, it was so beautiful. So they come out, Kathy's holding his hand, and Daniel has this picture. And he goes.
Done. Done. Oh, that's beautiful. That is absolutely beautiful.
That was a beauty.
Well, you said in that interview, diversity. I mean, I have two Asian children. It's not an issue for me.
No.
It is not an issue for me. It was very impressive.
Yes.
It was like, this is, why are you even asking me? This is not an issue for me. That's what I remember.
Yeah, you know, I actually had because that's a perfectly good answer and everything. I mean, my entire life I worked in the Army.
Yes.
Okay? I mean, it is, we figured it out a long time ago.
Yes.
And I know I got, Carol Gold had asked me a question with a little edge on it and everything. It had to do with the treatment of women. I said, yeah, I actually don't understand this because we have figured this out for a very long time. If you are a major in the Army with 14 years of service, you earn X. There's no check that says, and you earn X minus 15% if you're a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Pay them all exactly the same. Every promotion board has the requirement to, based on a very simple assumption, if 21% of all the majors in the Army are women, then probably 21% of all the lieutenant colonels in the Army ought to be women.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not, please explain. I mean, that's pretty much what the challenge is. I've been in 3-4 promotion boards, and we've never had to go back and check because it's just true. The law of large numbers just has it. So we just don't have any problem with it.
Yeah.
We just don't have any problem with it at all. Academia has a tremendous problem.
Yes, it does.
We know that the recruitment is pretty well gender balanced, that tenure is pretty well gender balanced. What happens is full professor is just bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's 70-30, 65-35, something like that. It's pretty bad.
It's out of whack, yeah.
And what I've thought there is the thing that happens there is you don't have that enormous advantage of the Army that says we will put everybody together and have a centralized promotion board screen them.
Yeah.
Here you're dealing with a person you know and a person you know.
Yes.
Pick one. Mm-hmm. This says there's the whole spectrum. Find the ones that ought to serve at the next higher rank. And you go, there they are.
Yes.
It works for ethnic groups, and it works for gender, and that's the only two things that we check.
Yes.
Okay? You know, we have X percentage of the Army is Afro-American, we have Y percentage who is Hispanic. What is our next thing? Okay, fine. Looks good.
Yeah.
And it does. I mean, the assumption that service and intelligence and excellence is not a matter of race, creed, or gender is absolutely accurate.
Yes.
And the Army proves it. Every single time they do a promotion board, there it is. There it is. But academia hasn't figured it out.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a little break then?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, we'll